they have their reasons for calling it a scam, but like predicting that it's going to zero next week, kind of, I don't know, it's sort of a stupid call, a pointless blunder. Like, Biden's not going to screw around and mess with any of the narratives. We have all these wonderful narratives, sound money, decentralization. No one's going to mess with this for a while. And so as long as each cycle is doubling or so, all the miners will be well fed, and no one's going to try to kill their goose. Now it has to go meet here. And this is an example of a dynamical system, which is, it's unstable. This isn't the same thing that I you know, got interested in like 8 or 10 years ago. This is more like, I don't know, it seems just like a bunch of people kind of pumping their bags.
This podcast is entertainment, not financial, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed represent statements of the speaker in their individual capacity, do not represent the views of Unchained, and should not be considered investment advice. Speakers often have personal, family, or business connections to Unchained, which may include direct financial benefits. Please see our disclosure at unchained.com/podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Frontier podcast. This week, I have on Micah Warren. Micah, welcome.
Thanks, Joe. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you. I think you're one of the very few academics that really engages seriously with Bitcoin. What's your background and what led you to starting to think about Bitcoin?
Well, actually, this goes back to my undergraduate. I was a computer science major in undergraduate. This is the late 90s. And I was very fascinated, interested in the internet as it was starting to explode. I planned to do something with computer science. As I was exploring the internet, I ended up like exploring places in my university's computer system that I wasn't really allowed to. They noticed this and they decided to discipline me. And so their discipline for me was to have me go write a 20-page essay on the ethics of digital privacy in the internet era. And so it's like, okay, I was actually like, I thought they were going to make me do something unpleasant, you know? So I was like excited to do this. They gave me like the summer before my junior year to complete this project. And I was like, okay. So I went and this was the late 90s. The cypherpunks were fully in bloom. And I was found all sorts of resources, all sorts of literature about digital privacy. And so I ended up going way down this rabbit hole, learning all sorts about cryptography. And of course, in the process, I learned about this crazy idea that people had proposed that someday there would be this like cyber money that, you know, you could, you know, is cryptography based and it was sort of anonymous or maybe not, or maybe it had all these different features. It's censorship resistant. And it was, you know, this was fascinating. Of course, it was only kind of pie in the sky back in the time, something that people threw around. So I, you know, I kind of learned a lot about this, got kind of excited about it. And then, you know, ended up writing like a 100-page essay or something about digital privacy and how interested and fascinating that was. Went back to school in my junior year. And then I was, you know, taking a VLSI exam one day and a computer science chair comes in and pulls me out of the exam and he says, I need to talk to you. I was like, well, what? And he says, well, we learned from the university that you did some hacking and then we decided to go through your account and we saw that you, like, looks like you have the code to, like, you know, you wrote your own password cracker. And like, this is not acceptable. We have a zero tolerance policy. So you're not going to get a computer science degree from our department. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, this seemed like a little weird, but they had this was kind of an older gentleman who thought that the only use case for the entire internet was pornography. And so they, you know, I would think most kids would have at least tried something like this. If you got a computer science degree, you know, you'd try something anyways. But so this is the story of how I became a math major. So I got a math degree because I didn't get a computer science degree. Then I went to grad school, ended up going to writing PhD, going to Princeton for a postdoc. And I was at Princeton in 2011. Doing a postdoc, and I was talking to one of my friends who was at the Institute for Advanced Study, and he explained to me this thing called Bitcoin. And I was like, well, that's that thing that I read about it, like people were trying to get, and like, oh my gosh, how did they do this? How did they solve this problem? And I got kind of excited about it because this was like this really, you know, fascinating thing. I was so excited that someone had finally done this. But, you know, at the time, this was just like a solution to a hard problem. And it was really fascinating that anyone had come up with the idea. And I didn't, you know, of course I didn't think that like this was like global money or, you know, something that you would like hold. Like, I didn't make any sense. Like, why would you buy and hold this thing? And actually I seem to remember thinking that this was also something that like my friend's friend had invented or something. And like when he said it was anonymous, I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. You know, he doesn't want anyone to know. But like it wasn't until a little bit later, 2013, that I started looking deeper in it, that it was like, oh wow, this is actually kind of, you know, people are buying this and like holding it and watching charts of this thing. And so I got more interested now that there was like a little bit more global interest in people that weren't just kind of like math nerds were into this. So, you know, this was like 2014 when I started to like mess around. I started to learn about some of the other protocols. I was really interested in just like the whole, I guess, you know, people don't like the word blockchain, but like what was opened up by this whole idea. You know, this Bitcoin at the time seemed to me like a proof of concept, where you have this, suddenly you now can have this thing where people can create a way of consensus that doesn't involve any clear leaders or anything like this. And it's interesting to see what that opens up. So, you know, I looked at Counterparty, and then when Ethereum, you know, middle of the summer, 2014, I did a little bit of their crowdfund. And then I kind of like went into that direction, just sort of thinking, a lot of this was like not really related to my career, just, you know, on my own, thinking about this, like, how can this change things for the better? How can this make the, you know, the economy more, I don't know, fair? Because, you know, a lot of the goals back in the days that I remember them were like, we have this new tool. How can we use this to create a better world? Can we create like a way to, I don't know, disintermediate some of the exploitative corporations, you know, disintermediate Wall Street, this kind of, these were many of the goals. And so I was, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I was kind of hopeful for a while that like some of these other platforms like Ethereum or something would allow us to create something which would work, like which would actually be, I don't know, useful, you know, in our everyday lives. As I kind of researched more, I started thinking about more of the, I know, the darker side, like kind of the adversarial aspects, and then started kind of looking at like, I don't know, doing, you know, running thought experiments and trying to figure out what would go right or what would go wrong. I started to become a little bit more skeptical. And then in like 2017, of course, this is when we realized that like 99% of crypto projects are sort of scams, right? They're just sort of, someone came up with some idea, or they took someone else's idea and they put their name on it, and they, you know, buy my coin, give me exit liquidity. Awesome. And so this is kind of undeniable. And so now, you know, looking back, I see why like a lot of people who were sort of, you know, came into 2017, they're your instant reaction to anything with crypto is like, well, please, this is a scam. That's good. You know, it wasn't obvious to me like in 2014, 2015 that was what was going on. I thought most people were like curiosity driven, just trying to see what this could do. But then of course, we all saw what happens. The space gets overtaken by kind of scammy people. So, you know, I guess I was, then I spent some time in the next few years, I was interested in some of these protocols. Like I read a lot of the work from IOHK. They're kind of affiliated with Cardano. And I mean, these are real mathematicians, real computer scientists writing real papers. A lot of interesting stuff. I found myself critiquing the model. I mean, not the math themselves, which was usually pretty solid, but the models where the foundation of how this would actually interact with the real world. So then I think it was, you know, then 2020 happens. Of course, everybody, you know, after this lull, everyone kind of comes back to the internet because it's the pandemic and what else are you going to do? And, you know, the Bitcoin price starts skyrocketing, and we have people like Michael Saylor saying all these things like it's going to go up forever, et cetera, et cetera. And I found myself kind of getting this, I don't know, sour, like, this isn't the same thing that I, you know, got interested in like 8 or 10 years ago. This is more like, I don't know, it seems just like a bunch of people kind of, you know, pumping their bags, which I guess it's different than the crypto thing, which kind of made me sour on the crypto thing, but is it really, you know, like what's the real difference here? And so I don't know what point in time I decided, I kind of like was, most of my interaction was kind of through some alt accounts. Just kind of, I don't know. I would just sort of hang out and, you know, say stupid things. I wasn't under my own name or anything. And then one point I remember was, I can't remember if it was late 2020, early 2021, there was a debate on Clubhouse between Mike Kelly and Jimmy Song. And so the proposal that Mike went into debate was whether Bitcoin could be attacked by a nation state that was properly mooted. And so Mike's brother Joe had written up this blog post and said, okay, you know, if a nation state wants to do this, all they have to do is get a bunch of hash rate, start mining empty blocks, and then anytime anybody publishes a block, you just mine another empty block, and eventually You've denial of service, the whole thing, game over. So from one, you know, from one perspective, this seems like obvious. Like, how is this debatable? That's how it's supposed to work. Of course, people in the Bitcoin community did not like that, and they wanted to debate. So they had this debate, and a couple of things that came out of this. One is that, and this is something which bothered me a little bit, was everybody, or I don't know, everybody, there was a bunch of people on the call, you know, and they were like, they told Mike that he shouldn't be discussing FUD outside of the mailing list. Like, there was only, like, the mailing list was where this belongs, and you shouldn't, like, be having this in the public where anybody could just listen in and, like, hear this FUD, which seemed a little strange to me, because this is not my vision of how the project should be working. And the other interesting thing was, you know, what the debate hinged on is, like, you know, Mike said, of course, here it's easy, like, you just mine empty blocks, game over. And Jimmy Song says, well, actually, no, we would just use invalidate block, and we invalidate the empty blocks. Problem solved. Simple. And so, of course, you know, Mike comes back and says, well, they wouldn't just be empty blocks. It would be a spammy block. It would be some other block, which looks, might be okay, but it's probably bad. And it, you know, you could do all sorts of things where it's just, you can reorg, you can destroy the whole consensus mechanism. And, you know, of course, you know, Jimmy Song and other people on the call came back and said, well, no, actually, we would know who's publishing the malicious blocks, and we would just invalidate. And I thought about this, and I was kind of like very, very disturbed by this, because it seemed like this, like heretical, here, these people are saying that after all, we don't need proof of work, right? At the end of the day, you know, it protects us at the start of the day, but then if somebody attacks it and they gain control over it, well, we don't need it. And this seemed just sort of like a crazy paradox. And I thought this was crazy at the time. And I should say, since then, I've realized that there's actually quite a bit of more interesting nuance here. And that's, you know, when I actually went to write all this stuff down, I realized that, like, actually, this is very complicated. We don't actually 100% rely on proof of work as the only thing anymore. There's backups in place, even if we're not really explicit about them. And so, in this case, some of these people were sort of explicit, and they said, well, the community would be able to, you know, right the ship if there ever was an attack. But, you know, this concept fascinated me. Like, how does this actually work? What are the rules? Because no one had really written any of this down. It was just like, okay, we all know that it's secure because you can't attack it. It didn't really make sense to me. We could all see the halvings are starting to come. We all know that number is not going to go up forever. There's going to be a point where we actually have to wrestle with this. And, you know, someone needs to actually have a serious discussion about how this works. And it can't be between these people that are just like calling it a scam, end of story. And there's lots of people in academia who are just, you know, it's a scam. It's going to go to zero next week. They have their reasons for calling it a scam, but like predicting that it's going to zero next week, kind of, I don't know, it's sort of a stupid call, a pointless blunder. So people who don't understand the protocol, understand why people use it, people who never got excited about the protocol, I don't think they're going to have a really good discussion with someone who's like, kind of thinks it's cool. I think it's cool. I think it's fun. For a lot of time, I've kind of rooting for parts of it to work. And so I wanted to have this, you know, I saw this sort of opportunity, like somewhere in the middle where there's these people that are just sort of, you know, they're just well into the Kool-Aid punch bowl, that are just writing these kind of ridiculously bullish scenarios with no drawbacks. And then you have all these folks on the other side that are just saying it's going to go to zero next week. And so I said, yeah, look, there's almost nobody who's actually trying to bridge this gap. So I started writing up some notes, and at some point in, I guess, 2021, I was emailed kind of randomly by someone from De Gruyter, and they wanted me to write a textbook. They were curious if I was interested in writing a textbook in differential geometry. And I said, actually, I don't have anything, because that's sort of my bread and butter. I said, well, but, you know, I just want to toss this out there. Would you be interested kind of working on some notes about like Bitcoin game theory? And they got back to me and instantly were like, oh, yes, we got to do this. So that was September 2021, I think. And so I turned in the book like a year later, September 2022. And then I think March 2023, about a year ago, was when it was published. And so that's how I got here.
Awesome. Yeah, that's very cool. I'm curious about your textbook on Bitcoin. What has been the reception from your textbook from, you know, Bitcoiners themselves, or also academics that, you know, happen to read your textbook, or whoever's read your textbook? Like, who What do they say about it?
I've gotten it's a little bit maybe too mathy because I kind of fall back on what I'm actually comfortable with. I've written, you know, hundreds of pages of math papers over the years, so like I probably put in too much math in it. Which it's hard to be specific if you don't have math. I haven't gotten too much response. Like I sort of expected more negative response from more people in Bitcoin because I mean towards the end I started to say here's all the ways things could go south. But I don't think I mean I'm not trying to sell myself as like a big Bitcoin hater. So I haven't heard a lot of negative feedback on the book. I don't know how many people have actually read it to the end. So
yeah, that's pretty fair. I guess textbooks can be long anyways.
It is a textbook. Yeah. And so this is, yeah. It's sold as a textbook. And so people are like, well, why is it $60? And it's, well, textbooks tend to be that.
Yeah. Makes sense. I'm curious, and you don't have to answer this in detail, or you can kind of answer it in however we want to word the answer. But do you personally own Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies?
Not really at the moment. I mean, I still have some old wallets, like still have my Counterparty wallet with a bunch of one Satoshi and sort of random things from like 2014. I have and it's just got dust. I have some small wallets that just have like, I don't know, 0.001, something like that. I sold most of my stuff. End of 2021, I was like, I'm tired of the ups and downs and the taxes. And so December 31st, 2021, I just like wiped out all my accounts at every exchange and haven't bought anything since then. And I'm okay with this. It's kind of nice to watch a bull market without being like waking up in the middle of the night going, you know, should I sell?
Yeah, the volatility can be definitely taxing. I guess forget what you think is likely based on like what you've written in your textbook and the thoughts that you've analyzed over the years. Do you personally like want Bitcoin to succeed, or do you believe Bitcoin is a good for the world, or do you question that it is or it isn't?
So yeah, the issue there, or the question there is like, what do you mean by what is Bitcoin? Like I'm not, like when I kind of went sour on it, it's when this narrative that like, it's just like what Michael Saylor is selling. It's that this idea that rich people have all this extra money and they don't have any good ideas with how to invest their money. So they need somewhere to put it. And that's like, I would rather they invest in some research or do something which will give them return in real value in the future. You know, you can not worry about the gauge, whatever, I don't care the dollar value, but you know, typically speaking, investment is so you gain real value. I would rather people be using their excess money for that.
In this frontier moment, Micah is suggesting that it's better for wealthy people to invest their wealth rather than just hold Bitcoin and do nothing. It instinctively reminded me of this quote from Pierre Richard, VP of Research at Riot Platforms, where he said, "Holding money is the greatest form of charity that anonymously increases the purchasing power of those who need to spend while respecting the integrity of their dignity." Printing money is the opposite of that. I think that's a really great quote from Pierre. And I think right now, many people invest in things like houses, bidding up the price of homes, hoarding them, and then renting them out. If these people were just sitting on Bitcoin, there may be more houses available for sale and the cost of living may drop. So I don't think it's quite right to say that sitting on Bitcoin would be bad. There is a role for savings. And now back to Micah.
You know, beforehand, like my, you know, I thought of this as a good thing as like kind of just a, you know, a layer of kind of, you know, extra protection against, or you know, something which that people could use if they were not very well served by the financial system. If you needed to get money out of a country or something and the authorities are after you and you needed to, you know, there's all these wonderful use cases where you can think of this as a good thing for just kind of basic, you know, civil liberties type reasons, you know, anti-authoritarian, you know, overall it kind of in this low-key, like a non-Wall Street setting, it decreases the legibility of money. And, you know, decreasing legibility is something which decreases the likelihood for authoritarianism to happen. So like if people are using kind of a currency that can't be monitored and controlled, you're less that, you know, these people are less likely to fall into the hands of authoritarianism. This is kind of just a general reason why you might want something like crypto or Bitcoin or whatever to work. And I was kind of aligned with this. But this to me isn't the same as like, you know, $1 million Bitcoin held by all these corporations and these nation states. It's completely different. So I'm not really rooting for that version. The old version, like if that could happen, I become less skeptical that, or more skeptical that that's going to actually happen over time. But I would still say I was sort of rooting for that.
Gotcha. Yeah. So like Michael Saylor kind of has the view that Bitcoin is like savings technology, and you actually, there's not a reason to always be perpetually investing. And you think that that's not necessarily good for the world, where you think people should constantly be, if you earn profits from one enterprise, you should invest in research or another enterprise. Is that correct? Or am I?
Well, I mean, this is the way that, you know, capitalism was taught to me as a, you know, young kid growing up in Ronald Reagan days. Like, people are rich because they were smart. And then, you know, they take their money and they do something else smart with it. Because otherwise, like, I mean, we might as well just have a wealth tax. but I'm not advocating for, you know, necessarily the extreme version of that. But if rich people are just going to sit there and get richer, then what's the whole point of like, you know, this idea of capitalism, you know?
Yeah.
That's what they do.
For sure. I mean, would you not have issue with, like, I would contrast it to like the current system today where, you know, if you're worth $100 million or $1 billion, you can sit on real estate or S&P 500. And not only does that go up in value, but you can extract, you know, rents and yields and dividends from those assets. Whereas, sure, Bitcoin can keep going up for however long, but at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to earn yield off your Bitcoin. So it's like, it's not that like rent seeking type thing that kind of exists in today's system. Would you agree with that, or would you disagree?
Well, it's
that?
A different kind of, I mean, there's good rent seeking and there's bad. I mean, there's rent seeking kind of has a negative connotation, but sometimes like you're actually, you know, investing in something which is useful and you're getting profits from that. That's not necessarily bad. I mean, you're obviously earning some kind of, your number is going up somehow. So like there's some balance there. I don't know how to describe it. Some balance where.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Let's dive into some of the work that you've done, I guess, in your textbook and elsewhere. I know in the future you think Bitcoin's hash rate could be highly volatile. Can you maybe explain that with, I know you're behind a whiteboard, so maybe yeah. Explain what your thoughts there.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a kind of a fun set of pictures I like to draw. Let's see. So draw a couple pictures. So this curve here, this is like a 1/x curve. Right. This is going to represent what the difficulty adjust. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put hash rate here. You know, whatever units, I don't know, terahash per second. And for any given, so in order to draw this curve, we have to say there's like a fixed price, right? So Bitcoin, $70,000 today. For the next 2 weeks, depending on the previous 2 weeks hash rate, we're going to get, you know, this curve is going to determine the reward you get for your hash, right? So this here is for dollars per hash. I won't put the units, but you know, the more hashes out there, the less you're going to get from mining Bitcoin. So another important curve is going to be this curve here. We'll draw it like this. This is the marginal cost of producing hash. So the idea here is you have, you know, the first people that produce hash are going to be the ones with the most efficient machines, going to be the cheapest electricity. And so there's a low marginal cost. And so it's implicitly ordered here that assume that you do that. The first, you know, 600 terahash or whatever of hash rate is produced by the people that can produce it at the cheapest. So once you get to say whatever 600 terahash per second, the next 50 terahash per second is going to cost more than each of the previous terahash per seconds did. And this marginal cost is what represents that. And we expect this to have this kind of little bit of a flat slope, and then it's bridging up, and then probably not too far past what we have. I don't know what the number is. Could we get to 1,000 terahash per second if the entire, everybody in the universe started like hashing on the computers? I don't know. There's some sort of acid, right? So this here represents the equilibrium, right? Where the marginal cost of producing hash is the marginal return on producing hash. So this is the same. Now, it can be interesting to ask what happens if there's a shock. And I guess the most obvious sort of shock is what's going to happen in like 2 weeks, next week or something. There's a halving, right? So this halving is going to take this difficulty adjusted curve, and it's going to drop it by almost two. I mean, it's slightly more than two, or slightly more than a half, because the fees should keep up a little bit. But you roughly have a new curve here that looks something like. And so if this were immediately to go to equilibrium, you would have, this is the new equilibrium, but it doesn't immediately jump there. Right, this is the sort of mathematical equilibrium, but dynamically it might not happen. What's going to happen is that when the halving happens, the rate is the reward is going to drop in half. I think I drew this slightly higher than half. Let's be fair. So it's going to kind of come down here, and then there's going to be it's a bit of a mess. I'll zoom in a little bit. The halving happens, things drop by half, and then the new rate is going to be determined by whoever's marginal cost is above this half of what it previous. So, right. So if your marginal cost, if it costs you $50, or you know, that's not correct. You know, $50,000 to mine a block, and then I should probably stop making up numbers. But the if it drops in half, then you're going to be here. You're not going to be necessarily here, right? So you're going to drop. You're going to go here. This is going to be the hash rate. So what's going to happen then is after the 2 week period, you've lost all this hash rate. The difficulty, or not this curve, is going to adjust upwards. So the difficulty adjusts upwards, and it's gone beyond equilibrium. So it's gone up, and then you do this thing where you then go, so now the reward is more, and so you go back over here, and so that tells you that these many folks are mining. And the way I've drawn this just sort of randomly is it looks like it's actually going to go around in a square. Now, the interesting thing, maybe I should say, typically, if the slope is steep, and this is what I think usually comes out to, if the slope is steep, you get a new curve, what's going to happen is it's going to spiral in, and you're going to converge to the new equilibrium. The fun stuff is what happens if it's not steep. So this is what happens. So these curves, these difficulty-adjusted curves, they're going to push inward over time with the halvings. They push outward as the price goes up. They push inward with the halving. So these marginal cost curves, they push to the right as more ASICs are produced, as more electricity goes online for the purpose of mining. These push to the right. There's this very possible situation where you have something that looks like this. Then when you do a halving, you go down and you see where this intersects this curve. It comes way over here. So you could lose, say, you know, if the slope of this marginal cost curve is shallow, you could lose, I don't know, 70% of the hash rate overnight. But then what happens if you've lost 70% of the hash rate? 2 weeks, well, not 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. The reward just jumps. Reward jumps by a factor. And so you go way over here. And then, I don't know if that's off the screen, but then, you know, you can see that this now it has to go meet here. And this is an example of a dynamical system, which is... it's unstable. So as long as there's a key thing is, again, this slope here, if it's steep, you have this dynamical system which converges. If it's shallow, you have a dynamical system which does not converge and will sort of escape off, be sort of wildly volatile.
Interesting. So like, is there, obviously that hasn't quite happened yet because of the curve in your view is steep enough, I guess.
Yes.
Is what's like the tipping point in your mind that would cause this to eventually occur? Like what would cause the flattening of the curve?
So like I said, these, like now, I can sort of draw this now versus maybe then.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably 2011, something like mm-hmm. that. 2013, like that. But also the numbers got huge, right? So we still got this steep slope here. We still got this steep slope. And then you got, you know, 2017, something like this, right? And then, oh, we got a bunch of ASICs, but also the production of ASICs has not completely gone way beyond what's needed, right? So the bad thing would happen is if maybe we produce a bunch of ASICs, right? So now we got this really super long curve, sort of flat part of the curve. And then instead of things doubling every 2 years or 4 years, they don't. And so your curves are sliding backwards. And then instead of kind of being at this point where you have all the slack is you know, it's really tight, you're at this other, you're down here or something and it's flat. So this would just mean more ASICs are produced and are just sort of hanging around, ready to turn on or off, whereas the price is not kind of growing exponentially.
Gotcha. So your view is just difficulty starts going all over the place. It goes very low to very high, and then all these ASICs turn on and all these ASICs turn off, and it could happen over and over again, basically.
This episode is sponsored by Sound Advisory, an Unchained affiliate. If you can't talk about your Bitcoin wealth with your financial advisor, it might be time to find a new advisor. Sound Advisory is a leading financial advisory firm for long-term Bitcoin holders like yourself. If you need help optimizing taxes, establishing goals, creating a distribution plan for Bitcoin wealth, or designing estate and inheritance plans, then check out Sound Advisory at thesoundadvisory.com for more information. That's thesoundadvisory.com. Now back to the show.
Yeah. In fact, I think this has happened like Bitcoin Cash.
Yeah.
But not for the same reasons. You know, it's a different dynamic because this is kind of like the main show. So, but if you have like Bitcoin Cash has to deal with the fact that there are other things you can do with your machine. Like if you don't want to work money mining Bitcoin Cash, you can go mine Bitcoin. And so, you know, Bitcoin doesn't quite have that same easy available alternative, but or at least now. And the scary available alternative would be attacking. But I don't think we're anywhere near that yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this as like a problem for Bitcoin in the future, other than like, you know, it might take you out one day, you know, like a day to get a confirmation versus some days it might take you like, you know, a minute?
I don't know if the variability of, I don't know if this dynamic system per se would necessarily be a huge problem. It would be more of an indication of the fact that you have a lot of miners which are really kind of on the cusp of profitability or non-profitability, which means that they could, you could get into as more of a phase shift, a security phase shift, where they might be interested in making coalitions or attacking each other or doing something to artificially wind down the hash rate so that they can kind of keep their profit. And I think on the long run, this is something which I think, and a lot of people that are into Bitcoin don't like this, but I think that at some point miners are going to make a move, and this will happen about the time when their profits are kind of like evaporating. They're going to make a move to form some sort of coalition to ease down the hash rate and kind of control everything through a few people.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of want to get into the idea of attacking Bitcoin. So now you kind of set it up somewhat. Like I've heard you talk about this before in the past. You've suggested that Bitcoin, the long-term, you know, sustainability of Bitcoin from producing blocks from miners, that there is a problem with how miners might interact with the Bitcoin system. So you still feel that way? And can you kind of explain your thoughts?
Yeah. So I've kind of had to, you know, a lot of varying thoughts over the years, and starting with this like conversation between Mike Kelly and Jimmy Thesom, it occurred to me that there's actually, you know, the miners, you know, they don't control it, but they do. You know, it's kind of this weird paradox. Like if they attacked it, what would happen? And this is something which you have to, if you're doing game theory, you have to ask, like, what if somebody attacked Bitcoin, what would the miners do? If miners attacked Bitcoin, what would the market do? Or whoever else is sort of in charge or not in charge, what would they do? And this is, you know, like easiest example to talk about is a double spin. And I don't think double spins are going to happen anytime soon. What would happen if we woke up tomorrow and there was a double spin? Like, well, you know, if we looked and all of a sudden there was like this 10 block reorg and we could see there was this $12 million transaction that was gone and replaced by this other transaction. What probably would happen is the miners would break Nakamoto consensus or sort of ignore it for a few hours while they continued to mine the original chain until this reorg chain was no longer the longest chain. And why is it now this at first when I started to process this, I thought, no, like that's crazy because you're destroying Bitcoin if you break the rules. But really, it's totally feasible now. Because you know, if you've listened to, say, Bitcoin Mechanic talk about the current state of the mining system, you have like 12 people who are writing block temp, right? So there's only a handful of active mining corporations. There's only a handful of template writers that are writing blocks for pools. You know, I don't know if the number's 12, but 12 is not a big number. So it would be very easy for the CEO of Riot and Marathon and maybe a few other people just have a quick conversation, get like 60% of the hash rate. We are going to ignore this double because it's not good for the ecosystem. And then they would have to, I mean, the reasoning for this would be it's bad for Bitcoin if we see double spin. And I think most people would agree with that. Like most, like very few people would sell if they saw miners fix it, right? I mean, maybe some OG, there might be some OG people that are like, no, that's it, game over. Like if miners did this, it means they're colluding and we can't trust anybody. But a lot of people would be scared if they saw the double spin sort of honored. So the miners would probably make this really simple decision to not honor it. And they don't have to honor it. They sort of are in control in this sense. And they can go back and they can write the chain. And it's like the double spin never happened. So that's kind of like a simple example where, you know, you have, there's an attack. And then the response to the attack is determined by how people will react to the reason. So this is something which, you know, it's often given by a game tree where you have like a, someone's making a decision and then the person below them has a decision. And then they're usually basing their decisions on how they think people will respond to their decision. So at the end of the day, if there's any attack or monopoly mining or selfish mining or anything, the people involved in this decision are going to go to the next step and they're going to say, okay, if we start selfish mining or if we start, you know, just kind of winding down the hash rate by ignoring blocks from certain miners, or if we start making sure all our blocks are OFAC compliant, or if we start to do any of these things, is this going to force people like Michael Saylor to sell? And the answer is usually going to be no. So they now have a little bit of leeway to do some things which might be considered in it.
Interesting. Can you kind of elaborate on like what specific, like get into some of those attacks? Maybe it's selfish mining or reorging a double spin or actually performing a double spin themselves. Like, can you dive into like what attack do you think would be most likely? And can you kind of explain it to the audience?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like, I think a double spin is not going to happen in the current regime. In 20 years, if the price is $5,000 and it, you know, then there might be double spins. But I don't think double spins are going to happen in the immediate future for the reason I just described. And that's that, like, there's enough miners. There's very few miners with enough power. The power is concentrated in the miners that they will just ignore it and say it never happened. So double spin's not a worry. Also, I don't think a nation state attack is going to be feasible in the near future either. I mean, largely because the nations aren't going to do this. Like, I couldn't imagine the US getting together the political power to like actually go after this. I mean, if they did, they could. But I don't see that sort of thing happen. You could imagine like a rogue nation, somebody we don't know from somewhere else trying to like attack the system. And even if they could like come up with, say China wants to attack. And even if they come up with enough hash power and they instruct Bitmain to make enough machines to do this, it would actually be pretty trivial, or just like with a double spin situation, for these 12 people to just get on a call and say, yeah, we are going to ignore these blocks. And this is exactly like what, you know, Jimmy Song had suggested, and now I sort of agree with, is that like it's kind of easy to just form like a little circle the wagons and use kind of sort of permission thing. And in doing this permission thing, you would be asking the question, are we destroying this whole ecosystem by becoming permission? And even though like originally 15 years ago, this was, you know, this would have been a horrifying idea that you have this like little permissioned system that's run by 12 people. If ETFs own it, if Michael Saylor owns it, if nation states own it, and they're all just kind of good, upstanding, well-behaved people, nobody's really going to care. Because it doesn't, like, it's not like you're trying to bribe somebody, you know, with your Bitcoin, right? Like most people that are holding it are not doing this. It's not being used for the same purpose as it was, you know, 13 years ago. So I don't think there would be that much resistance. And then you could get in a situation where you just have a de facto cartel that is just, and then once they do this, they could wind the hash rate.
In this frontier moment, Micah is suggesting that there is potential for a centralized cartel of miners to eventually emerge. Personally, I see this as a very low probability. It assumes that mining will become a small permissioned group of participants. But in reality, mining is always an open global network. If a small group of miners does collude and censors transactions for whatever reason, then those being censored could pay higher transaction fees to encourage other miners to join the network and mine the transactions for profit. Micah assumes that this will never happen again once a cartel emerges. He also assumes that the cartel will retain control of the longest proof-of-work chain forever. Additionally, as the block subsidy trends to zero, this threat of selfish mining censorship becomes less of a threat as miners aren't subsidized by the block subsidy for mining blocks without transactions. The only clear way for miners to make money in the future after the block subsidy would be by including transactions that include a fee that pay the miners. And now back to Micah.
They could just say, hey, you know, it's, you know, we're spending $50 billion a year on mining. We're getting $53 billion a year in return. What if instead we spend $20 billion a year and we get $53 billion in return? It seems like a much better deal. So they could wind down the hash rate kind of in a nice, agreeable way. And then they have a bunch of profit. And they could also... Gotcha. They could also make any censors happy. Like if we want to kick terrorists off the network, you can do that now if it's just a few people that are explicitly.
Gotcha. So your view is eventually at some point down the line, When do you think that this might occur from your perspective? And then like when this does occur, like what, so you're basically suggesting that a small group of miners are going to 51% attack the network, selfish mine, collude, and then no other outside entities are going to try to, say like, actually let's build on this other chain. And now they don't have 51% of the network. Now we have, majority of the network.
Yeah. So you could start it with an actual 51 where like you're physically kicking them out by producing more proof of work. But after a while, you could also just say, if we invite this back to the old fashioned way where we're reorging each other, that's just inviting chaos. And who wants chaos? Like if I want to know that my blocks are going to happen every roughly 10 minutes. And if I have like a permission group of miners, which are doing this with sort of reduced hash rate, they could literally do this like every 10 minutes by reducing the hash rate enough and just sort of firing up the machines, kind of taking turns every 10 minutes doing this. This would be easy to do, right? I mean, and it would be like, the person that, or the rogue group would just coming in and trying to use the old fashioned proof of work, but now be disrupting the system. And there would be, I guess, the will would be, or in my guess, this is my guess, provided a situation where like Wall Street and everybody is holding ETFs, they don't want this disruption. They just want like a, block after block after block. And permission miners could provide that much better than miners being attacked by other miners. As far as gotcha. The time,
yeah.
My guess is, so we're on this upward trajectory and no one's going to mess with it. Like miners aren't going to screw around and mess with any of the narratives. We have all these wonderful narratives, sound money, decentralization. No one's going to mess with this for a while. And so as long as each cycle is doubling or so, all the miners will be well fed and no one's going to try to kill their goose. So I don't see that. I mean, if it doesn't go be above 75,000 this cycle, then we might start to look at this happening in the next 4 or 8 years. But as long as it's going up, miners are going to be reluctant to do this. At some point, though, it has to sort of stabilize. It doesn't make sense that like everyone's going to always eternally be involved in some sort of FOMO frenzy. At some point, it's going to stable out. The profit margins are going to dwindle and people are going to get maybe a little bit bored with it. Like, it's just an asset. It's just something you buy. I don't care. We won't, perhaps even some of the original, this is something we've seen recently. A lot of people are kind of, in the last few days, last month, so people are, there's this kind of anti-Michael Saylor narrative that I've seen a lot. Like part of it, because I guess there was some story today that happened that I didn't completely follow. But 3 years ago, everybody was just like, number go up, this is awesome. And now there's sort of this like, is this really what we want? Do we really want the ETFs? Do we really want Bitcoin as property? Do we really want all this? And, it's possible over the years, these people that are questioning that are going to be replaced by people that are just sort of the Bitcoin is property that you can hold in an ETF account or however you want. And in that case, it wouldn't be, it would be easier for the miners to do something without spooking the system. This is something which I call the market fragility hypothesis, which early Bitcoiners had. And they said, if the miners were to do anything horrible, then everybody would leave and the game would be over. Everybody would go home or they would, use Monero or they would use something else. And this, I think, was true. Like in the first, 5 years, if miners would have started selfish mining or done something untoward, people would have ditched their coins and said, this project is obviously not working out. These days, it's not so clear because I don't think that you would have like $1 trillion just sort of vanishing in thin air because miners tried to push some rules or, started doing selfish mining. I don't think that would spook very many.
Interesting. Yeah, because I know like Marathon, for example, they... Previously, maybe it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, maybe less, they announced that they were going to censor specific transactions that are coming from, unregulated addresses. Then the community got definitely mad at them and they definitely walked that back. They weren't going to like 51% attack, but they themselves, their mining pool, I know, was not going to mine those specific transactions. So like, does that not somewhat at least counter your argument that the community
But maybe they try it again. I mean, maybe they try it again in a few years and nobody cares. And I mean, people got mad, but that's, people saying stuff on Twitter or whatever is one thing. Were they really going to sell their Bitcoin? If OFAC or if they stopped mining OFAC transactions, would people sell? I'm not convinced people would just start selling. Like they would be like, okay, party's over. This was fun. I'm going to go get a real job. I think people would continue exactly as they've been, they've been doing.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Interesting. So I guess what do you think would change? Like, why has this already not happened? Where like a bunch of miners collude and start selfish mining? Like, why is this going to occur at some point in the future, but for some reason it hasn't occurred quite yet?
Well, like I said, we're still on this upward sort of hopeful phase where miners, a lot of them are still bullish, and they're saying, you know, can we last a few more cycles while it keeps doubling or tripling or whatever? And they don't want to spook that. And so as long as everyone's just kind of looking to the next cycle, looking to 100K or 500K or whatever the next goal is, they're not going to want to see any of this. And they want, I don't know what, if there's a magic number. Some people imagine like, once it gets to 100K, everybody will take this seriously. Or once it gets to $1 million, everybody will take this seriously. I don't know that there's a magic number. I don't think there is. I think that people always think this magic number is just like the next level. Like, we're almost there. We just need to like keep playing by the rules, and then pretty soon everybody will be involved, and the number will be an order of magnitude higher. And I think that's kind of the mentality right now. Is it would be really ugly if there's no reason to do. And as far as I know, like I think the miners are well fed. Like, I don't think they're at this point in time. I mean, the halving, we'll see. We'll maybe lose a few folks, but I still think now they're doing pretty well. I don't know this. I'm not a miner, but I don't think they're really like struggling to, you know, pay their debts quite yet.
Yeah. I mean, in previous bear markets, when Bitcoin has fallen, 70%, 80%, like we have seen minor capitulations where like hash rate drops off fairly significantly, whether it's at a halving or just the prices dropped significantly. And like miners definitely have gone out of business. Like, why do you think that hasn't happened in the past where, okay, now it, like 10 years ago, maybe it was even easier for miners to collude because there was like, a few thousand people, dealing with Bitcoin. Whereas now it's like, it's a lot bigger of an industry. It's a, $1 trillion asset. So why do you think in the past it hasn't quite happened?
Well, I still think the miners that are well positioned are doing well enough that they don't want to mess with. And I don't have like numbers on their industry, but for the near future, as long as you feel like you're well positioned for the next cycle, I think you would still not want to mess. I think there's still enough. We're in this range where we still have somewhat of a market fragility hypothesis where people would get really spooked. I mean, we just got the ETF like 2 months ago, right? So, or 3 months ago. So we, there's still this hope that, we're going to get this rush of new investment, and you don't want to do it then. And in the bear market, when everything's crashing, you don't want to do it then either. Because if you did in the bear market, that would be like, then everybody would be like, okay, this is really a failed experiment. You're in a bull market, you're scaring off all the potential new investments. So I think what it would have to be is something where it's kind of just sort of stabilized. And we're not there yet. As long as we have all this volatility, I don't see any of these sort of attacks happen.
Fair enough. I it's interesting that I agree. Definitely, like, I don't see these attacks happening, especially anytime soon. And it's interesting how you don't own Bitcoin, or you're not necessarily super, you're not bullish on it per se, or you're skeptical at least, if that's fair to say.
Well, yeah, there's skeptical on the price and skeptical on, the value or different things. Like,
okay,
skeptical on whether it's going to be more in a year. That's one question. Whether I want to actually hold it myself, that's a different.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Yeah. Do you think, in 1 year or 4 years, the price of Bitcoin in terms of dollars will be up or lower?
I think I'm going to say yes, probably up.
Okay.
Probably up. Yeah.
Fair. What do you think? Like, do you think Michael Saylor, do you think he like recognizes your perspective, or like, do you think he like hasn't thought about it, or do you think he thinks you're wrong? Like, how do you think?
He's a funny guy. I mean,
yeah.
So like, because some of the things that come out of his mouth are just so crazy. Like, he has to just be fully aware that he's just kind of playing a role. I think it was a What Bitcoin Did podcast. It started out where he went on this little rant where he tells people you can't trust people's words. You have to look at their financial motivations. And he segues into this rant about Bitcoin, right? And it's like nobody caught on. Like, this is like. Was that just an inside joke? Like, here was like somebody who was just saying all these words, pumping Bitcoin. And he's also telling you, you can't trust people. Can't trust their words. You have to look at their financial motivation. It's like, okay. He's kind of like, did he just like kind of take a dig on himself that nobody caught? Or like, I mean, yeah, he's a funny guy. I don't know. He's obviously like, he plays a character. So I don't know what goes on in his head. It's exactly the same thing that's coming out of his mouth.
Oh, interesting. So you would say that, you think that like he just has a massive Bitcoin position and he's willing to talk it up as much as possible, and he doesn't and he knows that there may be potentially issues like you think that you've pointed out, and he doesn't care to acknowledge this.
Yeah, I mean, he might also be of this idea that if you get mass adoption, then these aren't really potential issues. Like if the attack is thwarted by just a bunch of people coming together and permission mined, but the number keeps going up, and that's not an issue that he really has to deal with. So that might not be a drawback. He's not trying to do anything. He's not buying used bike parts from Craigslist in the Walmart parking lot or anything. Like, he's just holding it. So he doesn't have the same motivations as, say, the people that originally were using Bitcoin 13 years ago.
Yeah, that's a good point. I enjoy hearing your perspective, because it's actually, it's good to think of, not maliciously about Bitcoin, but to try to poke holes into it to see like where might issues be, and if, the community can eventually fix them or do whatever to fix them. Another kind of follow-up question related to this is like the underlying cryptography behind Bitcoin with the, public keys and private keys. And you may not have a good answer. I don't know if you've done research on this topic, but is there any concern with like cryptography evolving over time and, eventually people figuring out that, the public key cryptography like BCDSA is insecure, and that is a problem for people holding Bitcoin in a certain way?
I don't see that as a real risk. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. Of course, if there's some sort of amazing quantum stuff that happens, it's not just Bitcoin that's going to be in trouble. It's going to be like everything. Everything that involves the internet is going to suddenly be insecure. So I've never heard from any serious mathematician or cryptographer that we have to worry about, breaking BCDSA.
Well, that's good to hear.
that's not a question. Yeah. How people value stuff and buy things, that's the huge question.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
It's really an issue.
Fair. Well, Micah, it's been about an hour. I think this was really good. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you want to share with the audience?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'll pass.
Okay, fair enough. Cool. Well, Micah, I really enjoyed you taking the time to talk with us. Where can the people learn more about you or connect with you if you want them to ever connect with you?
I am on Twitter. I think I'm going by M. Warren at the moment. This used to be Akeem Warner, which was just my name, kind of letters mixed around. But it's Achimwar. I also have like an academic webpage if you wanted to email me through my University of Oregon address or something. But every day I do go to Twitter.
Awesome. Great to hear. We'll all see you on Twitter. Micah, thanks again. This was great.
Yeah, thank you.